So at what point did you find out that Fox was planning to model a TV show on your article?
It was within a few days of the article coming out that I learned that there was some interest from Hollywood. And, you know, this happens from time to time when you do long magazine articles. It's not something I ever take very seriously. I don't write articles to see them on TV. I don't work in Hollywood. And any other times this has happened in the past, it generally fizzles out. You might get some call, ooh, you know, Fox and NBC and HBO or whoever. Martin Scorsese loves your Rolling Stone article. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, you're hearing nothing. So in the case of this, it was a couple days I heard that some TV networks were interested. Ultimately, Fox ended up optioning it. And here we are, not very long afterwards, I'm talking to you from Chicago, where I was on the set of the show earlier today, and it's very surreal.
I play a genius tech billionaire who purchases a failing police precinct and techs it up.
What if there was an Uber-style app that replaced 911?
The APB app, real-time crime reports. They just became your partners.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, also writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds and the case of JonBenet Ramsey. And with me today is
Laura Richards, advocate, analyst, and activist, and I'm founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also co-creator and co-producer of The Case of JonBenet Ramsey, and I'm calling in live from London via Skype.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And we're going to be continuing our conversation with David Amston, the writer of the New York Times article, Who Runs the Streets of New Orleans? So if you're not familiar with what we're talking about, we should repeat what we're talking about. So we were approached by a sponsor. Fox approached us to sponsor our podcast and have advertisements for APB, their new show. And they told us that it was based on this article by David Amston. And we read the article. We were really intrigued by it. It brought up all of these issues that we're talking about. And it just seemed like a great time to bring up this topic.
Right. And so we wanted to talk to David, so we brought him in to Real Crime Profile so that our listeners can all get the benefit of his insights in researching the article and writing it, and also to see what the effects of him writing this article were, because they had very real life effects.
Right.
And it affected Hollywood as well.
That's right. And we're really grateful that he was able to join us on this very cold day in Chicago where he had to come and be on our show. And we're really thankful for that. But before that, I wanted to just talk about this entire concept of privatized police force, because there are a lot of different kinds of.
Yeah.
And people are very confused about them. So I wanted to just sort of go through the different types.
Well, you know, first of all, people should be aware that there are 17,000 police departments in the United States of America. And most of them are tiny little departments of 2, 3, 4, or 5 people. Although then you have New York City Police Department, which is 30,000 plus, and Los Angeles, which is about in that same area. But that adds up to about 600,000 sworn police officers in the United States of America at all the various levels, local, city, state, federal. So that's a big number. But would you be surprised to find out that private police officers, security officers, actually double that amount, at least 1.2 million.
Oh, yeah. I was surprised until I read his article. Yeah. But yeah, that's crazy.
It is. Well, because many of these officers carry guns and have the ability to make a decision on whether somebody lives or dies. And certainly that's a real responsibility. So when you start privatizing that, who is the ultimate arbiter of who lives and dies, who gets arrested and who doesn't? And that probably shouldn't be just the person who's wealthy enough to pay for that service.
Yeah, and especially when a bunch of these factions are operating within the same city. So we should break apart. So there's private security for businesses, right? And like the cops that protect like Facebook and all of these, you know, very highly secured businesses.
Locations, right?
So
Disney and so forth.
So they have their own police. Now they can they arrest people or?
Well, they certainly can. I mean, an arrest is not accomplished by simply saying the words "you're under arrest." Arrest is preventing somebody from free movement. And that can be done whether it's intentional or not. I mean, if they do something that causes somebody to be detained, then that could be seen as an arrest under the law. But on top of those places that you mentioned, another sort of business location where they have private security are college campuses, universities across the country. And some of these are actually little cities. Some of these forces deal with 65,000 people under their jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's like the University of Chicago, right? Yeah.
Massive populations. And these are privately funded, privately controlled, privately trained police forces.
So the university in that case is the one funding those police.
Right. But the university is a corporation. The university actually is there to educate, but to make money. Slightly different goals than the government. I mean, the government is not in place to get a profit. And sometimes, especially, let's look at the rape crisis on college campuses and universities in the United States. All those crimes under the Clery Act have to be reported. They have to be documented so that when parents are sending their kids to that university, they'll be able to look up and see what their incidence rates of crimes are and rapes, for example. And you wouldn't want to send your kid to a school where you found out that there were 15 or 20 or 30 or 300 rapes over the course of a year. So it's in the interest of the university to have those reporting numbers down.
Yeah.
And we found that many of these situations, the university encourages the victim not to make a formal report or complaint or follow through with complaints that they make because it's bad for the image of the university. So that's just a similar instance in which the image and the business side of an organization or business might actually step on the toes of what the government should be doing, which is protecting its citizens.
Well, there's also one other private police force that probably many of our listeners are familiar with, and those that exist within like a residential area, either a gated community or maybe an apartment complex. And, you know, some of them are they're veritable security guards, basically.
Yeah.
But in one case in Washington, D.C., you know, they killed somebody.
Right.
And the mother didn't even know that her son had been killed for months. Much longer than should have been in a normal situation, and she wasn't there when he died, and so it's, you know, who's overseeing all
of
these?
Well, that's, I think, one of the biggest things that this brings out, the oversight, and people who are in a position of chief of police or sheriffs, many times they're elected or they're appointed, and the person above them is elected, and so the people can speak by voting. But in a situation where you have somebody who has money taking responsibility for policing, there's no vote. Mm. You can't vote that person out of office if that person is a billionaire. So it raises these issues, really interesting issues that I'm sure the show APB is going to tackle. There's indications already in the pilot that I've seen that they're going to deal with some really real down-to-earth issues revolving around privatization of police departments.
So some of our listeners know that I posted this article on our Facebook page, The Who Runs the Streets of New Orleans, and invited you, your comments and your questions. And a lot of your questions were exactly what Jim was just talking about. You know, where is the oversight on all of these different factions of special police? And I have to say, when I read this article, and I don't have anything against Sidney Torres, but somehow he just annoyed the crap out of me when I read about him and his whole Rico Suave and his ponytail and his goatee and his Armani.
But that's
I know. I don't know why. I mean, I'm sure he's a lovely person.
Well, what's, and he,
I don't know, something about it. Like, this entitled guy, and he gets his TV stolen, so that's all of a sudden why he's interested in fighting crime. Yeah. You know, to me, that's just
such arrogance.
And I'm sorry, but I'm sure that he did a lot of good. I mean,
yeah, but I don't know if it's born out of arrogance or just his ability to see a problem and then respond to it, actually do something about it. He had the means. So he was able to do it. Many people are frustrated because they're in a situation where something terrible is happening and they can't do anything to stop it. So I don't blame him for that. I think that's a great thing. He didn't just sit back. He didn't move to a different neighborhood and say, the hell with this one. He actually did something about it.
You know, I do take your point that, you know, Sidney Torres did not just up and leave his community. And I do think it's important for citizens to be involved in crime stopping and look out for each other. And I'm completely in favor of that. And I think it's really important. And it's very effective. But I guess I'd rather see it in not just the French Quarter, that we care about, you know, all the pockets where there's crime going on in a community and not just, you know, where all the tourists hang out.
Right. But I think that actually, if you look at Rudy Giuliani and what he did in New York City, I remember when I was going to law school and I live very close to Times Square, and I'd walk down there a lot at night just because I couldn't afford to sort of go out and go to clubs and all that. But I could go down and people watch. And that was something that led me to a career in behavioral analysis, which is kind of great. But it was very seedy back then.
Oh, it was so dangerous. I remember this
dangerous
very well.
And seedy, and, you know, porn shops all over the place and drug dealers, and it was horrible. And Giuliani decided, you know, it's the broken window issue. If it's a broken window, somebody's going to want to break in there. Somebody's going to want to commit a crime. But if you clean it up and you board up the windows or you put a new window in, then it's much less likely that somebody's going to break into a place. And it's only a piece of glass, but it actually does prevent crime. Even though you can see through it, even though it's easy to break, once it's broken, crime will go up. Once it's fixed, crime will go down. So that was the theory upon which he basically cleaned up all of Times Square, and then it gradually kind of moved out further and further. And today, they can't build enough hotels in Manhattan, in any of the boroughs, to house the number of tourists who come to the city every year. And because of that, they're turning tiny little SROs, you know, places that basically homeless people stayed in. They're turning them into these boutique hotels, and they're charging $200, $300, $400, $500, $600 a night for these rooms, because now Times Square is so popular, Manhattan is so popular with tourists, it's flooded with people from all over the world, and that's a good thing for the city, and it's helping the city continue to stay alive and to grow. So that theory is not a bad thing, because I know that the one thing that drives tourism, the greatest thing that drives tourism to the state of Louisiana, is that French Quarter in New Orleans. So if that is creating a situation in which it's driving an industry, and, for example, the industry, motion picture industry and the TV industry has gone there in droves because they gave them tax breaks, and you have to protect those people, otherwise they won't come back.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing thing. It's a human thing. And I think that because of that, I think that Torres actually stumbled onto something pretty big here. It does have ripple effects, and we need to talk about that, and we'll talk about it more with David.
Can I tell you that you just reminded me when Times Square was really, you know, at its seediest and worst, there's a street called Theater Row where all of the actors go to rehearse and do their little plays and everything. And the subway stop on 8th Avenue, like, it's really far away from those theaters. And I just remember coming up from the subway and running those avenues to get as quick as I could to the theater.
Yeah, you're talking about off Broadway there, right?
Off Broadway. But I remember being just terrified. And, you know, you're rehearsing late at night. And so anybody who, you know, decries the gentrification of Times Square, I'm like, yeah, try walking those long city blocks, you know, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I mean, even in the subways, I mean, there's a lot of long tunnels underground. And back in the day, they weren't well lit and they were they weren't policed. There was no cameras in there being monitored or anything. And I think it was very dangerous down there. And I've had to walk through them late at night many times. And it's a lot better now.
Yeah,
it's so much safer for anybody to be in the city. And I know that, you know, having spent the better part of my life in New York City, that it's an amazing place. It's got such an energy. I love it. And I love it so much more now because it isn't crime ridden. The street crime is down to a minimum and people are able to go out and enjoy the city and walk around, because for me, the best times I've had were walking around Manhattan. I think it's just an amazing place filled with all sorts of wonder.
Mm. You know, I did go to New Orleans once all by myself when I traveled around the country after I graduated from college. I took a train all the way around the country. Mm. It was really cool. But the time that I was the scaredest in New Orleans was not at night, but during the day, because I got up out of my hostel, you know, really early, and I went, you know, 7 a.m. walking around, and there is like nobody.
Well, in the beginning of the day, yes.
Yeah, but even like in the middle of the day, I just remember walking down the street and there was a kind of a guy coming towards me and I'm looking around like, oh man, if, you know, if he does anything to me, there is like nobody, nobody on the streets. But anyway.
Yeah, well, I too went to New Orleans by myself one time, and the first time I ever went there, I went on Halloween. And so the night of Halloween is slightly less decadent than Mardi Gras, but it's pretty similar in the quarter. So it was pretty intense. It was insane. There was a lot of craziness going on, lots of drinking, a lot of very, very drunk people in public.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that, you know, given all that, there was no incidents that happened that I witnessed or that happened to me. But during the day, the next day, I had my backpack on and I was going to the airport, and somebody, while I was walking through the quarter, somebody was able to get into my backpack while it was on me steal stuff from me.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
So very, very expensive pair of binoculars that are used for work. That were taken out of my bag and some other things. So I was really bummed when that happened. But yeah, the fact is that taught me about crowds and, you know, even if the sun is shining, pickpockets are still around.
Yeah.
And you know, that, by the way, I would never walk out in public, even with a wallet in my pocket in New Orleans during Mardi Gras or even on Halloween, just because you're literally pressed front to back to other people. People are bumping into you all the time, and you'll never be aware that they've just taken whatever you had in your pockets.
Okay, so with that, why don't we get back to our conversation with David Amston. David, are the police that work for Sydney paid the same as the NOLA police or the other police force?
Well, you know, I can't speak for where it is today, but at least when I was doing the story during, you know, the pilot period and what followed that, which brings us pretty close to present day, I think there's a scale for NOPD officers working overtime. You know, there's two or three tiers of an hourly payment based on what the job is. And in the case of Sydney's, he was paying them the top, which I think was $50 an hour. So that's in turn. So what you're asking is, you know, these are already salaried employees of the NOPD, and this is them working overtime, which is something police officers in, you know, around the country and in all cities and districts do. They might be hired someone might want a police car at a wedding, someone might want a police escort for a block party or a parade. You would write in and pay that cop out of your pocket. Essentially, Sydney's just doing that, and he was paying them, you know, very, very high price. I know that the police officers during, you know, festivals that, you know, work overtime through the NOPD to, you know, for something like Jazz Fest or during Mardi Gras, I don't think they make $50 an hour. So he was paying them very well.
Did you have a sense from the officers, like, did any of them prefer to work for Sydney? And, you know, it just seems like that could be quite a conflict, you know, between the officers on the street.
Yeah. Tell me about it. I think in the beginning, you know, especially during the time that I was reporting on this piece, the program was so new And it was all happening very fast, and it was all happening in response to a lot of, local tensions and political tensions that there wasn't a whole lot of sense of time to reflect. You know, at the time I was reporting it, these officers had only done a couple of shifts. I'm sure they had things that they liked about it and things that were frustrating about it, but I don't think it was as nuanced as, who's this guy Sydney? You know, people know Sydney and they like Sydney. And you know, at the end of the day, what Sydney was doing is he was putting up money and he was coming along and he was, you know, sort of cheerleading this on. He'd talk to the officers before shifts and after shifts. He would try to ask them, you know, what can I do better? What do you guys want? He'd tell them what he needed and try to incentivize them with, you know, as I put in the article, you know, little gift certificates, things like that, that I think, you know, rubbed the wrong way against some of the NOPD
brass. But he showed visible leadership as well, it sounds like, David. I mean, in terms of going out, speaking to them and asking them what they wanted and how he could assist to do their job better. I mean, that sounds like visible leadership.
Yeah, I think at the beginning, you know, I mean, he had his own credibility on the line, right? I mean, he had his own money on the line, and now he had his credibility on the line. So, of course, he wanted this to succeed. It would not look good for him, let alone the city of New Orleans, if it didn't work. And then this becomes this really interesting question of, you know, this model, is this how we want to be modeling, you know, police forces, you know, with this kind of cycle of, you know, oh, you can say, oh, isn't it so great? Look at him giving the pep talk. But is he going to give that pep talk once his $500,000 is spent and this gets, you know, moved over to the next payment plan? You know, I think the answer to that is no. He moves on to something else. It's like a startup. You know what I mean? If you're starting up a company, you're really excited for the first couple of months and then you pass it on, you know, a year or two later to a CEO so you can, you know, work your mad genius elsewhere. And that's, you know,
I was just going to ask, what about the staff? I noticed, you know, we've kind of talked about men being on the payroll, but are they female and men, you know, both genders that have been working on this?
I mean, we're talking about a very small staff. There's a rotating core of police officers who do this. And, you know, there are women and men. In terms of the actual staff, I think there's just two or three people who kind of run it on a bureaucratic level and sort of, you know, whatever is involved in that connective tissue between this as a private enterprise and linking it up with the city, you know, we're really talking two people. So we're not talking about a whole employment structure where you can really break it down on, you know, oh, how equal is this on, you know, race, gender, et cetera. The cops are men and women, black and white. It's essentially whoever wants to work overtime.
Wow, this has been a really great discussion. And when we come back for our break, we'll have to continue.
We've seen a lot of cop shows, and this is an opportunity to play into those traditional scenarios, but attack them in a much different way.
And we're live.
Police, drop your weapons.
So you impressed with my technology?
So now we're back, and we're continuing our discussion.
So a byproduct of this article, which I guess got a lot of attention, David, am I wrong? I mean, this must have really...
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people read the New York Times Magazine, and I'm very grateful for that. And a lot of people take it very seriously. So, and this was coming out during a time, we're still living in this time, where there's a lot of questions swirling around police work and the ethics of police work and what would make policing better. So, yeah, it did seem to be, in my experience, an article that I had written that was, you know, quote unquote, buzzed about and talked about and debated at a high level.
So at what point did you find out that Fox was planning to model a TV show on your article?
It was within a few days of the article coming out that I learned that there was some interest from Hollywood. And, you know, this happens from time to time. When you do long magazine articles, it's not something I ever take very seriously. I don't write articles to see them on TV. I don't work in Hollywood. And any other times this has happened in the past, it generally fizzles out. You might get some call, ooh, you know, Fox and NBC and HBO or whoever. Martin Scorsese loves your Rolling Stone article. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, you're hearing nothing. So in the case of this, it was a couple days I heard that some TV networks were interested. Ultimately, Fox ended up optioning it. And here we are, not very long afterwards. I'm talking to you from Chicago, where I was on the set of the show earlier today. And yeah, very surreal.
I'm going to say, in my experience, this is amazingly fast for something to turn around from idea to development to
being.
I mean, that is like
in the scripted.
Oh
arena,
gosh! Oh
absolutely.
My goodness!
This is like the reality show timing for a scripted show, which is extremely rare. Which is good, because I think what it is a very hot, very cutting edge topic, and there's a lot of things that sort of flow out of this. And we'll talk a little bit more about the special conservators of the piece that have sort of sprung up around the country that are similar to this. But the show itself, though, you know, they have the lead character who's playing the Sidney Torres character. The character is Gideon Reeves, and he's a billionaire and he's a tech genius, and he wants to bring all that technology to the police department because he finds that they are working in the dark ages. And unfortunately, there's 17,000 police departments in the United States of America. Many of them are 2 or 3 man operations, and they don't get a lot of funding. And just like you said about New Orleans, their budgets are shrinking rather than growing to deal with increasing populations and increasing crime problems.
Yeah, I mean, the show is an interesting example, you know, and I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know what the outcome's going to be, but I'm very intrigued by it, because essentially what they did is they took what Sydney's doing in New Orleans, and they kind of gave it a steroidal injection, where we're, you know, instead of having just an app and a couple of cars, we have drones and new non-lethal weapons, and, you know, God knows what other surprises Fox will have up its sleeve for the show.
Certainly makes it exciting, let me tell you. when you see that, but you know, the concept of the show is that lead character,
yeah,
Gideon Reeves. The concept of the show is that Gideon Reeves, his best friend, is actually murdered, and the police have no suspects, and this is what pisses him off, and this is what gets him motivated to sort of almost embarrass the mayor into agreeing to let him bring in the resources. But he has a catch. He wants to run it. He wants to run things and bring in all this new technology that the police have never had at their disposal. So he comes in and he, you know, sort of retrofits all of the old, gets rid of all the old stuff that the police have been using, and actually brings in some really pretty amazing technology.
I think it's interesting, though, David, how it, you know, departs from your article, in that they definitely don't create a separate police force. You know, they definitely have this guy integrating into the existing police force without, you know, having that
100%. Yeah. It's not separate vehicles. He's taking the actual police force while they're on duty, not overtime, certain officers for overtime. And he's basically updating them technologically and tying them all together with this app. We have seen, the three of us, Laura, Lisa, and I have seen the pilot, and it's pretty engaging. It's
very fast moving,
very action oriented. Well, you have beautiful people doing, you know, crime fighting and
difficult jobs, and they don't have a hair out of place.
Well, David, you should know, though, that your lead, Justin Kirk, who is an amazing actor, who I saw the first time I saw him was years ago on Broadway in a play called Love, Valor, Compassion. Anyway, Justin is one of the most sought after people during pilot season. So I'm so mad at you that you've got him, because I really wanted him for whatever pilot I'm going to be working on. But I mean, that's okay. That's okay.
I was very excited when I heard he was doing it. I loved him in Angels in America. I loved him on Weeds.
Yeah.
You know, and I met him just a few hours ago, and it was, you know, just so surreal to see this whole set and to see these actors, and that it started and essentially was something that I wrote for the New York Times. Ooh, and nice. And for all the departures with the show, I mean, one, in the case of what Gideon, what the fictional Gideon is spending is just, you know, astronomical compared to what Sydney was spending. But what I do think is interesting is the instincts are kind of the same, and some of the questions they bring up are kind of the same. You know, would Gideon Reeves have gone to these lengths, these altruistic lengths, if it wasn't for something that happened to him? And yes, while it's always sad for someone to, not everyone who has a friend who gets killed can go take on and decide to retool the police force and essentially seek justice through this kind of management. And with Sydney, of course, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, would he have been this involved if his house didn't get broken into, if the bar, I didn't mention this earlier, next to his house hadn't gotten broken into at gunpoint at a very early hour? And then you have to ask yourself, well, does it matter? You yeah. know, does it matter if what, if the outcome, even in some small way, does improve, you know, law enforcement? I think, you know, hopefully in this Fox show, you know, while giving people a, you know, really fun hourly dose of awesome entertainment, where you also get to, you know, have the, you know, I'm a huge procedural junkie, so I love those TV shows that...
Really? Have you ever watched a little show called Criminal Minds, by any chance?
I watch a show called Criminal Minds constantly. Criminal Minds good. And Law and Order. I watch them. Good. I'm
We'd
not
love
lying,
to hear that.
That's the right answer.
But on just picking up on something you said, David, I think, you know, that is a true characterization. The fact that, you know, he's had a firsthand experience and therefore wants to do something. My experience of victims of crime, for example, or, you know, when we're talking about issues like stalking and domestic violence, it's only really when people have experienced it that they really get it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of the times people do things that are innovative or that are real trailblazing things and make changes when something touches them directly.
Right, exactly. And it's, you know, it's, what it gets interesting is when you put in the amount of money that certain people have, right? Like if someone is the victim of a crime and they start a small online forum for victims, there's not a whole lot of controversy around that. We think, okay, you know, this is a good thing to have in the world. But if someone, if a billionaire, a multimillionaire is a victim of a crime and says, you know what, I'm going to rewrite the rules of policing because I experienced a hole in this logic, and I'm going to fill in that hole with my prescription, and you're able to do that. And in a small way, Sydney was able to do that in New Orleans. And in a big way, you know, for the first season on APB, we're going to watch Gideon Reeves do that. And it does bring up these questions of, is this okay?
Well, I think that the show is probably going to explore those things. There's indications of that in the pilot. And didn't you watch them do some shooting today?
I did, yeah. I was on set for a few hours. Of course, I'm not allowed to talk about what I saw. Right. They were shooting the finale of season one. But definitely very thrilling.
But you guys are on location in Chicago. Were you outside today or were you guys inside?
We were outside all day.
You were outside?
Yeah, it was.
You must have frozen your
degrees.
Little tushy off. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Is it snowing there or not?
No, I think it's too cold for snow. It's hovering right around 0 degrees.
Oh wow! Awesome.
It's only my second time here, and even Chicagoans are saying it's cold. So I don't feel like such a wimp.
Then it's well, I'm just not a person who loves the cold. So I'm glad that we're actually in Los Angeles talking to you now from Chicago.
Okay, guys, just hold that thought. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion.
And he sees kind of what's going on with District 13 where I work. Overworked, underpaid, a lot of stuff coming through there, not enough personnel to kind of help out. You see Gideon kind of come in and bring his new equipment and his ways of solving problems.
Got a new coffee machine, too. Thing goes more than my house.
Okay, and we're back. Let's pick up where we left off.
But the fact is, on this show, they did raise a bunch of issues about both within the department and outside of the department. One of the things that you mentioned earlier that they did actually point out in the pilot is the introduction of non-lethal weapons to the police. Now, in this show, it appears that they're giving giving the officers basically what amounts to stun guns, ballistic stun guns. And so they're less than lethal force, but they control the person, and they seem to be hyper-accurate and very effective. I do think that in the real world, if you told police officers that we're going to send you out into a community that has guns, powerful weapons, but you can't have yours, I think that probably wouldn't work. But in this situation, a bunch of the police officers turned in those weapons. They didn't want to use them.
Oh, they didn't want to use the actual weapons or the newfangled weapons?
The newfangled weapons.
Yeah, they didn't want that. They definitely pushed back against that. They wanted their, you know. But I think that's going to be, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, I think it
is.
I mean, because, I mean, certainly, I mean, I was a law enforcement officer for 22 years. I carried a gun. I never actually shot anyone. I did shoot a rabid fox that attacked me, but that's a different story for a different time. But
that's a story that should be told at some point, though, Jim.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk about that. We'll figure it out when it's appropriate. But the fact is that there were several instances where I was authorized to use lethal force, but I was able to find a way not to. I didn't carry my gun as a light responsibility. It's a tremendously difficult thing to do, to carry around with you something that can take somebody else's life. But the reason I did it was because it's necessary at times to protect other people's lives. And that is an awesome responsibility, something that takes a lot of thought. But at the same time, our society, whether it's fortunate or not, in the United States, we sell over 1.2 million weapons a month. And usually at Christmas time, it's magnified quite a bit in the 3 weeks before Christmas. So there are millions and millions of new weapons going into the community every year. And yet police officers sort of have to deal with that because many of those weapons, a good percentage of those weapons, end up being used by people, whether they were criminals when they bought them or whether they were psychologically sound when they bought them or not, they end up using them in massive crimes, like we saw the other day in the Fort Lauderdale airport. And we want to reach out to the families of those victims and the victims who were injured and say that we're thinking about you and we wish that never happened. But obviously, this show is dealing with these very important and very current issues, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when it comes to something like these weapons, you know, and hopefully there's going to be a lot more of this on the show. We have it with drones as well. You think, I understand why the officers would be reluctant. It goes against what has been the way things have worked for so long. But what if, you know, this is what, you know, someone like Gideon Reeves, and we see this in real life, people like Elon Musk and a lot of these tech people, you know, and they love this word disruption, is, you know, I think it's an interesting question to chew over. What if you could invent a incredibly accurate, non-lethal stun gun of the sort that is on this show? I think for a lot of, you know, where would we be with some of the shootings that have proved so controversial?
Yeah, I agree.
This year. Yeah. It should be an interesting show that way, that it gets people thinking, you know, on all sides, maybe there are other ways to do this. Or, maybe this is just a completely ridiculous premise and someone needs to put a check on this guy's ego. And maybe it's a combination of all of that. You know, obviously that's what's fun for entertainment.
You need those kind of dreamers. I mean, you need those kind of people who are, you know, thinking beyond the box and look at, I mean, I always think of Star Trek, you know, how it was so strange to have those kind of communicators. And
yeah,
I don't
and
know.
Now everybody lives with at least one of them in their hands or pockets.
Right.
Some people have two or three. And it's far beyond anything that Star Trek ever imagined. The computing power that we have in our smartphones, just outrageous, and our smart cars, even more outrageous. So there's so much that can be dreamt of, and I would love to find ways that police didn't need lethal force. I think that would be a wonderful thing. It would be a step forward as a civilized humanity. And maybe, who knows, maybe the show will push some inventor like Elon Musk to actually create something like that that's effective and safe for officers to use and actually safer for the community because it doesn't put innocent people at risk.
Yeah, that would be incredible.
One thing before you go, I would like to talk about, I don't know how much you've looked into it, but these special conservators of the peace that have sort of popped up all over the country. Virginia is one of the states where they're fairly popular. And these are people who apply to the courts to actually get the right to act as an individual police officer or an agency that actually can carry guns and make arrests and write tickets and so forth. Have you looked into that at all?
I haven't, but I'm about to because that fascinates me.
Yeah, they're not really cops at all.
No, some of them are people who failed out of police departments and actually can get an application to carry a gun and to have police on their chest and carry a badge and drive around a car that has lights and sirens on it, even though they were, up until very recently, only required 40 hours of instruction. Now, just to compare, I mean, the average police academy is somewhere between 600 hours and 1,200 hours. Now, if this is a retired police officer who wants to do more and volunteer for his community, that's one thing. But when you have, and they actually have had in Virginia, cases in which, for example, somebody who failed out of the police academy, the state police academy in New York, became one of these S-COPs, S-C-O-P, became one of them and actually violated some people's rights in Virginia. They eventually took his license away or made him voluntarily surrender it. But the fact is that this kind of thing is cropping up around the country.
Oh, that is frightening.
We'll send you, Lisa found some great links, and so we'll send you some links to articles about that. And maybe you'll be heading off to Virginia. Hopefully it will be in the warmer weather.
Right.
Yeah, maybe. I'm super curious.
Well, I think we gotta wrap it up here, guys. Laura, did you have anything? Okay. So, David, my dear, even though we can't see your face, we want to thank you. Thank you so much for your time. And we do hope, you know, when you are in L.A., that we could, you know, get together, take you out to lunch or something for doing this for us. We really appreciate it.
And hopefully,
yes, thank you.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, we'll talk more about things because if you are interested in law enforcement and issues that come up like this, we have our fingers in that, and actually we're completely immersed in it many times. And there are things that maybe you might wanna write about because you seem to be somebody who's able to at least affect some actual change in the actual real world.
I'm always interested in, you know, keeping dialogues open, and one of the things I love most about my job is getting to meet and cyber meet all sorts of fascinating people. So of course, if there's anything, you know, I should be looking at, let me know.
And are you working on something right now that you want to talk about, a book or another article?
At the moment, I just finished a really long kind of crazy article for Rolling Stone about a USC athlete turned drug and gambling kingpin that came out a couple of weeks ago, and I'm taking a little, you know, I'm kind of in my germination phase on a couple of stories.
All right, everybody, thank you so much. And we're signing off for Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.